Welcome to the Heart of Show Business. I am your host, Alexia Melocchi. I believe in great storytelling and that every successful artist has a deep desire to express something from the heart to create a ripple effect in our society. Emotion and entertainment are closely tied together. My guests and I want to give you insider access to how the film, television, and music industry works. We will cover dreams come true, the road less traveled, journey beginnings, and a lot of insight and inspiration in between. I am a successful film and television entrepreneur who came to America as a teenager to pursue my show business dreams. Are you ready for some unfiltered real talk with entertainment visionaries from all over the world? Then let's roll sound and action.
Well, to all my listeners of the house, the heart. See, it's Friday, people. That's why I'm like confused and dazed already. But it is welcome to the Heart of Show Business podcast. Yet another fantastic episode with somebody who not only is a super well-known producer, director, multi-hyphenate, we'll talk about all that. But he's also a fellow Greek, Dimitris Logothetis, or as we say, Dimitris Logothetis, we say right in Greek.
Right.
So is here on my show. We're going to talk about his latest movie, Gunner, with our wonderful Morgan Freeman and one of the Hemsworth brothers. We're going to know who's the more handsome and talented. I'm going to put him on the spot. But beyond that, he also is the man behind King Sword Entertainment Part 2, the new version of King Sword. He has taken on all these amazing classic films of the 80s. He has also produced films with Jean-Claude Van Damme, Dennis Quaid, Kurt Russell, to name a few. He's been an EP showrunner at Warner Brothers. He is a martial arts, champion. I don't know how if you can define that. A martial arts pro with the franchise Jiu-Jitsu. And what else can I say? His latest movies were selling in Cannes. I got to take a peek at it, like, or at least know about it. And so welcome to my show, Dimitris.
Well, thank you, Alexia. It's very nice to be talking to you.
It's so great to speak to you. And honestly, you have me in martial arts because I'm not a martial artist, but I do think that some of those actors and talent who has are professional martial artists have had a very prolific career. You know, look at the Van Dams and look at, you know, all the people like the John Bautista and all the or David Bautista. See, you can tell like I don't know anything about martial arts and WME fighting or anything, but I want you to tell me, how do you get to work with all these incredible actors and why are you focusing on action and martial arts type of movies?
Well, I think, you know, when I first became a filmmaker, I was really a writer, and I started out as a writer, and I wrote an awful lot of projects, and I ended up luckily working in television, which gave me an opportunity to really focus on story. And, you know, the action itself is an obstacle. But the characters that I usually pick are characters that are up against completely unforgiving odds. So they have no chance of ever winning at all. And I'm drawn to those kind of characters. I write those kind of characters where they are just overwhelmingly going to lose. Okay. And so consequently, they go ahead and they choose to go down this path anyway, because they have a code, and these characters have their own code, and it's about family. It's about putting your life on the line for family, whether it's your own blood family or your own chosen family of friends. And you know, they're characters that want to do the right thing. And so I'm drawn to that. Now that action itself is just the obstacle, and the bad guys, et cetera, are the obstacles that are in the way of that. And so that's why I originally chose those characters. I think as a martial artist, you know, in my teens, I I got a black belt in Tangsudo, and I also got a black belt in Kempo. And Kempo was the style that Bruce Lee studied under Ed Parker, who was a wonderful sensei. And then Tangsudo, I studied under a world champion. And so it ends up creating a core. You know, there's a kind of a core that you learn. Most of the things that we do in life is all about childhood anyway. And so we develop all of these ways and the kind of character you have, et cetera. And I believe if I pull it off properly, that my characters have character and they're the kind of people that you look up to and you hope and you can live vicariously through them because, you know, so much of civilization today is about compromise. Well, you know, this guy's taking advantage of me, but what can I do? Well, you know, this woman's taking advantage of me, but what can I do? Well, the people at this company are not really doing the right thing and they're not giving me back the money that they owe me, but what can I do? My characters don't live with compromise. When something terrible happens to them or more to their families or somebody that they love, they turn around and they'll punch somebody in the face. They'll turn around and they'll take some action. They'll do the right thing. They'll do what we all want to be able to do. And so hopefully you live vicariously through these characters, not suggesting that you should do what they do, but certainly you can have some fun and lose yourself for about an hour and a half and forget about your troubles in the day and just have fun watching my characters do the right thing.
Wow. I love this answer. And I have to tell you, that's why you're such a great guest for my podcast, because this is exactly the kind of stuff that my listeners want to hear. I also read somewhere in an interview where you're talking about some of the presets of obviously martial arts being, or the principles being, loyalty, respect, and honor. And you and I both know that those qualities are not necessarily omnipresent in Hollywood business dealings. So I am...
Well, in life, I mean, I'm hoping that the younger generation of all kinds, because my films travel and they tend to last from one generation to the next, you know, I tend to make what's called an evergreen, where it gets relicensed over and over and over again. And hopefully they'll get something out of those characters where it's okay to do the right thing. It's okay to be loyal. It's okay to lose the battle by loyalty, because you're not going to lose the war. Okay. And so that's the kind of character I'm drawn to. I mean, look, I'm an immigrant. I came to the States when I was 6 years old, and my father, God rest him, and my mother, you know, my father was an auto mechanic and he opened up garages and gas stations. And so my entire life I would hear, you know, you don't really know anybody in the business. You don't have a chance. Oh, come on. You're wasting your time. You're never going to be able to write. Nobody's ever going to buy anything you write. Nobody's ever going to let you direct anything, et cetera, et cetera. And I find that I was against all odds myself. And I was being Greek and all, I was probably too stubborn or too stupid to recognize, why not me? Why not me? What do you mean? So, you know, I say to everybody who's got a dream, it's like, why not you? You deserve it just as much as anybody else. I mean, the one thing that my father used to tell me that resonates with me is nobody's better than you. Yeah. Nobody's smarter than you. Nobody has more skill than you do. And don't think for one second that you're better than anybody else. But you certainly have a right to succeed in life because of your determination. Okay. And so if you take that on, that in and of itself has a respectful statement in it, because not only should people not talk down to you, but you shouldn't be talking down to people. You should put yourselves on an equal level. Okay. And so that's how I proceeded.
Exactly. And I think when you are an immigrant, and obviously I can relate, being an immigrant myself, is you almost inherently learn to go with the flow, to be fluid, to be flexible, always keeping the eye on the top of the mountain, But you have to learn to be flexible, and you have to learn to be humble, and learn humble in a good way, not in a submissive way, but humble, like you said, cooperative, know how to respect people. Because I think that the people you're going to meet on your way up, you're going to meet them on your way down. Hopefully there won't be a way down for either of us. But I think the immigrant spirit is that resilience, that wanting, like you said, why not me? And it is so important. And I think you had that.
And this is the best kind of, pardon me for interrupting, this is the best country in the world. I mean, America, the reason we're here is because it's the best country in the world. There's a lot of things that we could not have done anywhere else.
Yeah.
This is the place to be. And I love being an American, but, you know, there's a spirit and a groundedness that I have. And so consequently, going back to the characters, I like underdogs.
You like underdogs. And so, were you first a writer, then a producer, then a director? Because obviously you shifted. And I'm interested to see how that process came about. I mean, what was the first thing you did? You just started writing a script, and then you ended up, you know, finding the money and doing all the things that a producer does. And then you said, you know, I want to be a director. I think I can do this because I've been on sets and I think I can do it. How was that transition?
Well, I was always a very good writer. Going all the way back to grammar school, storytelling was always what got me through school. You know, I could always write essays. I started out as an actor, not because I wanted to be an actor, because I was a business major at a junior college here, El Camino. And then I had to take either an acting class or a speech class, as it was an elective, you know. And so I decided to take the acting class. And the guy who taught the acting class was the head of the department over there. And he said, you know what? You're a pretty good actor. He said, I'm going to star you in the next play that we do here. I was like, oh, no, I don't want to do a play. Please don't. So in any case, I ended up doing this play. And then out of the play, I got an agent. And then I started to do commercials. And I started to act in movies. And I was doing very well. I was about 19, I think, 20. And I did a movie called New York, New York with Liza Minnelli and Robert De Niro. And I was on the set and I was still in school. So I was writing an English paper, and Marty Scorsese walks up behind me and he said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm writing this paper. I got to get this paper in, you know? And he says, let me see it. And I said, no, it's not ready to be seen. I said, you can't. And he goes, oh, come on, let me read it. I said, no, you know? So he takes it, you know? And he runs away with it, and he goes and reads it. He comes back. He goes, hey, you know what? You're a pretty good writer. He said, you should think about going to film school. And I said, what's film school? Because film school was a brand new thing. Nobody knew film school, you know. So he ended up writing me a letter recommending me to film school. And that was the beginning of the process for me, where I decided to start submitting applications to film schools. And I ended up getting a scholarship and all that kind of stuff. But that's how I got into filmmaking. And then through film school, I started to trip into a number of really good documentaries. I did a documentary for a rock group called The Knack, which had a hit song called My Sharona. They were the number one band
Yes.
at the time. I ended up going ahead and working for this cable TV company, which was a big deal at the time. And I just kept learning how to do things. Always that were writing based. You always needed to write. You needed to write a commercial. You needed to write a pitch. You needed to write a TV series for the cable company. And so the writing skills started to kick into gear. And then I got into television directing, because nobody else wanted to do it. It was non-union stuff, and it was overseas, and they consequently started to pick me to be the guy that knew how to deal with Europeans and go work overseas and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So, and writing was always the core, because I really knew story. And so one way or another, I'd end up writing, you know. And the only thing that was missing was trying to figure out how to raise money, which you often have to do as an independent. One way or another, you always have to sell these projects. And I wish to this day that film schools taught people how to sell, because you either need to pitch it to a studio, you need to pitch it to a foreign sales company, you need to pitch it to an investor. If you can't figure out how to put the money together, the actors and the money, et cetera, it doesn't really make any difference if you've got the greatest script in the world. I often tell everybody, I say, you know what? There's probably a lot of guys and gals out there that are much more talented and much better at writing than me. However, they really don't know how to put the project together, so it doesn't make any difference. I mean,
And I think in our days, obviously, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have all these places where we could research things. We could watch YouTube videos. You could, you know, you could talk to pros. You could book consultations. You could do all those things. And I think that was very, very challenging. I always say that to filmmakers, you are a writer. You better learn how to be a producer, a director, a distributor, a lawyer who knows how to negotiate their IP. You have to know a little bit of everything in order to navigate. I have a question though, because I feel, yes, the script sells it. The script sells the project. However, do you believe that it is actually the director who sells the actor to sign on to the project? Or do you think the script and the money is just enough? I'll be curious to hear your feedback on it.
Well, I call myself a filmmaker. Because I am. And I think that writing, producing, and direct, I mean, the only reason I produce is because if I didn't, I wouldn't be able to hire myself. So, you know, I hire the best man I know for the job. Yes. I think that the script has to be good. But at the end of the day, everybody, and they should, are going to look at who is making it, who's involved. And I think it's very important to have a director on board. Like, for instance, you know, if a friend of mine wanted to come to me and say, I want to do this big outlandish comedy, I'm the wrong person for that. I put a lot of humor in my stuff. And I pull off a lot of humor in action, but I'm the wrong person to try to pull off a comedy, you know? And so consequently, you really do have to do that. Now, there's often times where you'll get a newbie and people will back a newbie and try something new. But most of the time that doesn't work out. I mean, you know, the statistics for motion picture studios are that 7.5 out of 10 movies that they release fail. So they count on 2.5 to take them out. They count on the gigantic franchises to go ahead and make $1 billion today. And they go ahead and cover all the losses of the other 7.5 films. So there is no genius in this, in that nobody knows what, when they're making something, if it's going to succeed or fail. But you can at least say, you know what? He's going to make a pretty good movie. And as long as you can say that, then people are going to be comfortable getting behind it. And those of us that have been doing this for a long time, go, yeah, you know, that's a pretty good group of people that they put together there. I'm interested in watching that. Anybody who tells you, I know for a fact that that's going to be a smash success, they're lying, because they don't.
Yeah, I think longevity is indeed the biggest calling card. And I also see, even myself, when I'm working on projects, in whatever capacity, the fact that they know that I know distribution, that I know what the market wants, I know what the buyers want, even though I haven't personally produced the biggest blockbuster movies ever. I will, I'm on my way, but you know, I that's where I'm aiming for. But at least they know that they can trust me because I know the market and I have experience, as you do. We've seen it all. We've seen all the changes go through the 20, 30 years that we've been around. And speaking of the changes in that, have you noticed that there is a lot of actors from the 80s and 90s, we're talking the Van Dammes of the world, the Stallones, the Schwarzeneggers, even the Morgan Freemans, who still in today's world, still being older, they still have a value. I can't seem to wrap my head around anybody in the 20-something, early 30s generation that has the capacity or has the potential for longevity. Why do you think is that? Why do you think that those actors from those days still to this day are able to sell projects, especially in the independent side, where there's other actors who are the younger ones who somehow they work on a specific genre, but then people forget about them? Are they different movie stars? Are they no longer movie stars? Is the era of the movie star over, in your opinion?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that you brought up Stallone, And Stallone is, as far as I'm concerned, a genius when it comes to putting projects together that fit directly in his wheelhouse, you know. I mean, this TV series that he did, which he said is
Love it.
the hardest thing he ever did, is perfect Stallone. And it's cast in such a way that you have a really wonderful group of actors around him and young people, et cetera, but he's completely in his lane. And here he's coming out with Expendables 4, and he put together that whole crew of guys that you're talking about.
And
And
cliffhanger.
instead of playing a grandpa, which is what he should be cast as, according to Hollywood, right? Not according to him or the rest of us. He's still playing this big deal action star, and he's wonderful at stuff like that. So I think that to answer your question, you know, the buyers that you know that you're dealing with, I mean, you have certain sets of buyers. And so how do you get to your movie? How do you get your movie funded, right? Either you have a couple of people that really believe in you and they're willing to give you financing and they're willing to put up all the money for the movie, okay? Or if you're going to go with a conventional route, you're going to go to the buyers around the world and they're going to say, who's in it that I can sell to television? Because if I can't make any money anywhere else, who's in it that I can sell to television? And they're going to do what's safe. What's safe? Well, I've sold Morgan Freeman a lot. Well, I've sold Stallone a lot. Well, I've sold, I know for a fact that with these actors in the movie, I can go ahead and at least get so much money. And then they start to quantify. And they say, well, France is worth $500,000, $1 million, whatever, based on these actors, you know, as long as they're co-starring, right? And so I think that's the first tier. Now, after you get past them, then you have to get to the audience. The audience may not care whether or not you've got major stars in the movie or older stars in the movie or not. The audience cares about is whether they're entertained. And if you can't deliver their entertainment and they're not entertained, you're not going to do it again. I mean, that's just, it's as simple as that. You know, we happen to live in the $10 to $20 million film price range, okay, or less. Sometimes my friends are doing them for less. And so we're not going to get killed. You know, you come out with a studio film that costs 80, 90, 100, 120 million, you get one shot at that. And if that movie doesn't do well, then that's pretty much over for you know. So, I mean, it's really all about how many layers of sellers do you have to go to allow you to fund a movie and make your film.
Yes, absolutely. And I also think it's finding stories that are resonating with your talent, that your talent is willing to take pay cuts. I mean, my buyers were obviously output partners with Lionsgate, and they were behind the John Wicks of the world and all of those. And I mean, you saw Keanu Reeves' first John Wick. I mean, he was not his genre. He obviously took he came from the Matrix, which is different, but there was a moment where his career wasn't great, and he was smart enough to take pay cuts, just like Bruce Willis does. Just some of those actors, they take pay cuts because they see the universe being built around those characters. And I think that's another smart way to go, is to build universes. And that if you don't have a comic, or if you don't have something that's franchisable, at least build the universe. And I think the
Well,
Marvel
I think
is a universe like
with
you do.
John Wick specifically, because you brought it up, the director was the stunt coordinator from 8711, which is one of the biggest stunt teams in the world, right here actually, and he had trust in him because he'd worked with him already as a stunt coordinator, and so he trusted that he was at least going to make a really good action film. And he took a leap. And if you really, you know, I bring that up many times myself, John Wick, the original, because, you know, the story itself is a Western. In the original story, they kill his dog. And everybody thinks, well, he gets all worked up because they kill his dog. They killed his dog, which was the last thing that he had from his wife, who he adored. His character itself is a bad guy. He's a hitman. He's killed hundreds of people. He's one of the most lethal things that ever existed. However, just like I started by telling you, he loved his family. He loved his wife. He adored his wife, and that was where his heart came from. Consequently, like in The Godfather, you ended up with a character that all of us could relate to. It didn't matter what he did before, okay? And so they killed this dog, which was the last memory he had of his wife, and that brought him back into killing all these heartless people, okay? And then you went with it. You just said, great, okay? And that's a Western story. I mean, that comes right from the old Westerns, you know, where the poor kid or the poor woman or the poor this, I mean, Unforgiven, you know, it's about a bunch of hookers who, you know, hire these bad men to take care of this guy that cut up one of the young girls, you know. And that's the genesis of a story that ended up winning Academy Awards. So, you know, you always can relate to that guy or that gal who does the right thing, I think. And so that's where you go back to.
That is such a brilliant Instagrammable quote excerpt from this incredible podcast. Taking you back to Gunner, because I know you're in post-production with that, if I am not mistaken, because you showed me that you're
I am, yeah.
Is what are your hopes, expectations for it? Is because obviously you have an interesting combination of actors. Yeah, I know the story. You told me the story, but what are your hopes for it? Are you looking at this as a potential character that is going to be franchisable, or characters that are going to be franchisable and doing sequels, or are you going to move on to something else that is completely different after this one?
I never think about stuff like that. I try to make the best possible film I can. And I think these actors are so good. I mean, boy. Luke Hemsworth and Morgan Freeman. Morgan Freeman is like a poet, and you just watch him deliver these lines, and he makes a meal out of a couple of sentences that you never even thought would work, you know. And it was written by Gary Scott Thompson, who wrote the Fast and Furious multi-billion-dollar franchise. And I started working on this, I don't know, 4 years ago, I think. And I finally got it together. And the boys who are in this film as Luke's family are so terrific. They're also terrific actors. So the core itself, there's a lot of heart there. And then I brought my action team out from Thailand, who I started with the first Kickboxer remake, Kickboxer Vengeance. And then they did Kickboxer Retaliation with me, and they did Jiu-Jitsu with Nick Cage. And since then, they've worked on Extraction, they've worked on Gray Man for Netflix, they've worked on a number of huge films. And so this action team is a completely different action team because they're Thai, and the Thais approach action and martial arts action in a completely different way. And it's very unique to the Thais, you know. So, you know, I hope that everybody sees what I see in the film. And first, again, Luke Hemsworth has to buy your heart and get you to want him to win and recover his kids.
Yes, yes. Well, I have to say congratulations, because by Hollywood standards, setting up a project from a moment you pick a script to seeing it produced 4 years, that's pretty fast by Hollywood standards.
Well, if COVID hadn't gotten in the way, I would have been making it 2 years ago, so.
See, so that's interesting, because obviously that was not your own script. That was somebody else's script, and obviously came from a very major studio writer. Is there something, if somebody were to send you something, pitch you something, get hold of you, they say, I have something wonderful. What is your criteria? Are you necessarily always looking at known writers? Are you open to unknown writers? What makes you say yes? Because we all know the producer's journey could be a very long one, and we have to work very hard to get stuff done. What makes you say, you know what, I am going to dedicate the next year, 2 years, 3 years, however long it takes of my life to see this through? Is there something you're looking for in this?
I don't really know. I mean, I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, for the most part, I don't take anybody's projects. I write all my own stuff. And with Gary, there was a manager who I know who manages him and who brought me this story. And I didn't want to do it because I don't like working on other people's material, because you know, at any time they can decide to, I don't want to do this anymore, or I've changed my mind. And, you know, time is the only thing that you'll never recover. So with my own material, I know that if I'm going to put in a year or two or three, as you pointed out, I'm not going to look at myself and say, you can't work on this anymore. So, because you can't explain to anybody how difficult it is to put a picture together unless they've done it themselves, and that they'll tend to think that, oh, gee, you're not really doing this, you're not paying attention to it, which isn't the case. I mean, it doesn't behoove any of us not to make a movie. So we're at the behest of putting the talent together, putting the money together, putting whatever together. And sometimes, you know, I always tell everybody that films have their own life cycle. You can have the most, you know, Matrix. So pick any project. They can be around for a long, long time before they finally get made. And because they have their own life cycle, suddenly you attach somebody that you don't think would ever get something made, and it gets made.
Yeah.
So, what you should try to do is you should always try to do the best you can and deliver the best project you can. And I work on one or two things at a time. I'm not one of those filmmakers that can work on 10 things at a time.
Good for you, because you know what? It's so hard to multitask. I can tell you from my own personal experience, judging a zillion things, podcasts, you know, buying films for distributors, selling my own films, producing my clients' films, doing my own. It's a lot to handle. And I think I envy you in some way, because I feel that your martial arts background, together with, of course, your Greek roots, has brought you, maybe safe to assume, a sense of peace and just looking at life with a little bit of a different lens than a lot of people who are very frantic and they're just going into achieve. So what would be your, if you were to capsule it all into one, is there a life mantra? Is there something that you go by in whatever moment you feel you're a little stuck, to sort of reminding you about what's it all about and why is it worth it?
Well, again, I think first of all, Gunner is not a martial arts film. It's an action film. And so it's not martial arts centric at all. There's a little bit, but it's not what the other films were. Because of my background, and because, you know, one of the very first things I ever did was Champions Forever. And it was at the end of the careers of Muhammad Ali, Joe Frazier, George Foreman. And I put all those boxers together, and I did this documentary that ended up winning awards and was the number one documentary in the world at the time. Never intending it to be. I just wanted to put together these guys because I wanted to hear from these guys what it was like to start with nothing, and to end up with something, whatever you consider to be a success in your life. You know, everybody equates success with money. And if you get a little older, you understand that money has very, very little to do with success. You know, family is really more about success than anything else. Love is really more about success than anything else. And being able to be fortunate enough to do what we do is a huge success in and of itself, because most people are forced to do things just to get through life, okay? And we're not. No matter how hard things are, we're blessed to be able to do what we do. So what I found out from working with all these people, who are some of the sweetest people, you would think that fighters are mean and angry and so on and so on. I mean, even Mike Tyson, who I worked with on Kickboxer Retaliation, they're real sweethearts deep down inside, okay? And what the one winning thing is that I learned from them is when they got knocked down, they'd get up off the mat. Get up. You're not going to lay there. You're not going to quit. It hurt. Get yourself together, take a deep breath, and get up and get back in the ring, okay? And that's the thing that I can tell everybody. I mean, look, it ain't perfect. Nothing is. If you're looking for perfection, buy a grave. I guarantee you that you'll end up there, okay? But if you're looking to get through life, the one thing that will get you to step up, all the people that we've looked up to in our lives, where you see the Elon Musks of the world, where you see these people that have achieved all of these things that are just overwhelming and huge, and Steven Spielbergs and so on and so forth, they never quit. And believe me, they've had many failures. Everybody has failures. You fail. As a matter of fact, people who succeed have more failures than successes. All they need is one success. Okay. And, but you recover, you know, and you learn and you keep moving forward. So that's what I would say to people: get up off the mat and get back in the ring and start swinging again.
I love that. I love those life nuggets, because they just go in full circle with you wanting to do underdog stories. And if we think about it, most of the great ones in every area, whether it's science, whether it's, you know, the Elon Musk of the world, the great filmmakers, they are underdog stories. They started as an look at Stallone, right? His own story of how he got his own Rocky made and everything. They're underdog stories. So it only makes sense that you would have a passion into telling a lot of the stories with your production. And I have to say, this has been a total masterclass in producing and filmmaking. And I am so honored to have had you on my show, Dimitris, because I can't wait to start doing the show notes on this. It's going to be so many nuggets for the listeners to just go, wow, I'm inspired. I'm ready to create something for myself and for my life that is not just about money, as you said. So thank you for coming on my show. And before I close it off, I'm going to ask you what I said. I was going to ask you, which is, you already answered one of the two things, but how would you define yourself in three words? If you can say more, it's okay. I'm not going to like.
Oh my God. I'm grateful to be a storyteller.
That's beautiful. That is so beautiful. From the heart of show business with so much heart, Dimitris Logothetis, who really symbolizes exactly that, what my show is about, the heart of show business. Thank you, Dimitris, for coming on my show. Thank you to all the listeners. If you enjoyed this specific podcast episode, please subscribe, rate, review, share with your friends, share with those who need it when they're feeling down, when they feel like something is not working in their life. It's not just about show business, it's about life. And thank you for coming on my show, Dimitri.
Thank you, Alexia. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Heart of Show Business. If you enjoyed it, please share it with a friend. You can also subscribe, rate, and review the show on your favorite podcast player. If you have any questions or comments or feedback for us, you can reach me directly at theheartofshowbusiness.com.